Natasha. 1. On the stairs, Natasha ran into her neighbor from across the hall, Baron Wolf. He was somewhat laboriously ascending the bare wooden steps, caressing the banister with his hand and whistling softly through his teeth. "Where are you off to in such a hurry, Natasha?" "To the drugstore to get a prescription filled. The doctor was just here. Father is better." "Ah, that's good news." She flitted past in her rustling raincoat, hatless. Leaning over the banister, Wolf glanced back at her. For an instant he caught sight from overhead of the sleek, girlish part in her hair. Still whistling, he climbed to the top floor, threw his rain-soaked briefcase on the bed, then thoroughly and satisfyingly washed and dried his hands. Then he knocked on old Krenov's door. Krenov lived in the room across the hall with his daughter, who slept on a couch with amazing springs that rolled and swelled like metal tussocks through the flabby plush. There was also a table, unpainted and covered with ink-spotted newspapers. Sick Krenov, a shriveled old man in a nightshirt that reached to his heels, creakily darted back into bed and pulled up the sheet just as Wolf's large, shaved head poked through the door.
"Come in. Glad to see you. Come on in."
The old man was breathing with difficulty, and the door of his night table remained half opened. "I hear you've almost totally recovered, Alexei Ivanovich," Baron Wolf said, seating himself by the bed and slapping his knees. Krenov offered his yellow, sticky hand and shook his head.
"I don't know what you've been hearing, but I do know perfectly well that I'll die tomorrow."
He made a popping sound with his lips.
"Nonsense,"
Wolf interrupted merrily, and extracted from his hip pocket an enormous silver cigar case. "Mind if I smoke?" He fiddled for a long time with his lighter, clicking its cogged screw. Krenov half closed his eyes. His eyelids were bluish like a frog's webbing. Graying bristles covered his protruding chin. Without opening his eyes, he said,
"That's how it'll be. They killed my two sons and heaved me and Natasha out of our natal nest. Now we're supposed to go and die in a strange city."
"How stupid, all things considered." Wolf started speaking loudly and distinctly. He spoke of how Krenov still had a long time to live, that everyone would be returning to Russia in the spring, together with the storks. And then he proceeded to recount an incident from his past. "It was back when I was wandering around the Congo," he was saying, and his large, somewhat corpulent figure swayed slightly. "Ah, the distant Congo. My dear Alexei Ivanovich, such distant wilds, you know. Imagine a village in the woods, women with pendulous breasts in the shimmer of water, black as caracul, amid the huts. There, under a gigantic tree, ikiroku, lay orange fruit like rubber balls, and at night there came from inside the trunk what seemed like the sound of the sea. I had a long chat with the local kinglet. Our translator was a Belgian engineer, another curious man. He swore, by the way, that in 1895 he had seen an ichthyosaur in the swamps not far from Tanganyika. The kinglet was smeared with cobalt, adorned with rings, and blubbery with a belly like jelly. Here's what happened." Wolf, relishing his story, smiled and stroked his pale blue head.
"Natasha is back,"
Krenov quietly and firmly interjected, without raising his eyelids. Instantly turning pink, Wolf looked around. A moment later, somewhere far off, the lock of a front door clinked. Then steps rustled along the hall. Natasha entered quickly, with radiant eyes.
"How are you, Daddy?"
Wolf got up and said with feigned nonchalance,
"Your father is perfectly well, and I have no idea why he's in bed. I'm going to tell him about a certain African sorcerer."
Natasha smiled at her father and began unwrapping the medicine.
"It's raining," she said softly. "The weather is terrible."
As usually happens when the weather is mentioned, the others looked out the window. That made a bluish-gray vein on Krenov's neck contract. Then he threw his head back on the pillow again.
With a pout, Natasha counted the drops, and her eyelashes kept time. Her sleek dark hair was beaded with rain, and under her eyes there were adorable blue shadows. 2. Back in his room, Wolf paced for a long time with a flustered and happy smile, dropping heavily now into an armchair, now onto the edge of the bed. Then, for some reason, he opened a window and peered into the dark, gurgling courtyard below. At last he shrugged one shoulder spasmodically, put on his green hat, and went out. Old Krenov, who was sitting slumped on the couch while Natasha straightened up his bed for the night, observed indifferently, in a low voice, "Wolf has gone out to dinner." Then he sighed and pulled the blanket more tightly around him.
"Ready," said Natasha. "Climb back in, Daddy."
All around there was the wet evening city, the black torrents of the streets, the mobile, shiny cupolas of umbrellas, the blaze of shop windows, trickling down onto the asphalt. Along with the rain, the night began to flow, filling the depths of the courtyards, flickering in the eyes of the thin-legged prostitutes, who slowly strolled to and fro at the crowded intersections. And somewhere above, the circular lights of an advertisement flashed intermittently like a spinning, illuminated wheel. Toward nightfall, Krenov's temperature had risen. The thermometer was warm, alive. The column of mercury climbed high on the little red ladder. For a long time he muttered unintelligibly, kept biting his lips and gently shaking his head. Then he fell asleep. Natasha undressed by a candle's wan flame and saw her reflection in the murky glass of the window, her pale, thin neck, the dark braid that had fallen across her clavicle. She stood like that, in motionless languor, and suddenly it seemed to her that the room, together with the couch, the table littered with cigarette stubs, the bed on which, with open mouth, a sharp-nosed, sweaty old man slept restlessly, all this started to move, and was now floating, like the deck of a ship, into the black night. She sighed, ran a hand across her warm, bare shoulder, and, transported partly by dizziness, lowered herself onto the couch. Then, with a vague smile, she began rolling down and pulling off her old, oft-mended stockings. Once again the room started floating, and she felt as if someone were blowing hot air onto the back of her head. She opened her eyes wide, dark, elongated eyes, whose whites had a bluish sheen. An autumn fly began to circle the candle and, like a buzzing black pea, collided with the wall. Natasha slowly crawled under the blanket and stretched, sensing like a bystander the warmth of her own body, her long thighs and her bare arms thrown back behind her head. She felt too lazy to douse the candle, to shoo away the silken formication that was making her involuntarily compress her knees and shut her eyes. Krenov gave a deep groan and raised one arm in his sleep. The arm fell back, as if it were dead. Natasha lifted herself slightly and blew toward the candle. Multicolored circles started to swim before her eyes. "I feel so wonderful," she thought, laughing into her pillow. She was now lying curled up and seemed to herself to be incredibly small, and all the thoughts in her head were like warm sparks that were gently scattering and sliding. She was just falling asleep when her torpor was shattered by a deep, frenzied cry. "Daddy, what's the matter?" She fumbled on the table and lit the candle. Krenov was sitting on the bed, breathing furiously, his fingers clutching the collar of his shirt. A few minutes earlier he had awakened and was frozen with horror, having mistaken the luminous dial of the watch lying on a chair nearby for the muzzle of a rifle motionlessly aiming at him. He awaited the gunshot, not daring to stir, then, losing control, started screaming. Now he looked at his daughter, blinking and smiling a tremulous smile.
"Daddy, calm down. It's nothing."
Her naked feet softly shuffling on the floor, she straightened his pillows and touched his brow, which was sticky and cold with sweat. With a deep sigh and still shaken by spasms, he turned away toward the wall and muttered,
"All of them. All. And me, too. It's a nightmare. No, you mustn't."
He fell asleep as if falling into an abyss.
Natasha lay down again. The couch had become even bumpier. The springs pressed now into her side, now into her shoulder blades. But at last she got comfortable and floated off into the interrupted, incredibly warm dream that she still sensed, but no longer remembered. Then, at dawn, she woke again. Her father was calling to her.
Natasha, I don't feel well. Give me some water.
Slightly unsteady, her somnolence permeated by the light blue dawn, she moved toward the wash basin, making the pitcher clink. Krenov drank avidly and deeply. He said,
It will be awful if I never return.
Go to sleep, Daddy. Try to get some more sleep. Natasha threw on her flannel robe and sat down at the foot of her father's bed. He repeated the words, This is awful, several times, then gave a frightened smile.
Natasha, I keep imagining that I am walking through our village. Remember the place by the river near the sawmill? And it's hard to walk. You know, all the sawdust. Sawdust and sand. My feet sink in. It tickles. One time, when we traveled abroad...
He frowned, struggling to follow the course of his own stumbling thoughts. Natasha recalled with extraordinary clarity how he used to look then, recalled his fair little beard, his gray suede gloves, his checkered traveling cap that resembled a rubber pouch for a sponge, and suddenly felt that she was about to cry.
Yes, so that's that.
Krenov drawled indifferently, peering into the dawn mist.
Sleep some more, Daddy. I remember everything.
He awkwardly took a swallow of water, rubbed his face, and leaned back on the pillows. From the yard came a cock's sweet throbbing cry. 3. At about 11 next morning, Wolf knocked on the Krenovs' door. Some dishes tinkled with fright in the room, and Natasha's laughter spilled forth. An instant later, she slipped out into the hall, carefully closing the door behind her.
I'm so glad. Father is a lot better today.
She was wearing a white blouse and a beige skirt with buttons along the hips. Her elongated, shiny eyes were happy.
Awfully restless night, she continued rapidly. And now he's cooled down completely. His temperature is normal. He has even decided to get up. They've just bathed him.
It's sunny out today, Wolf said mysteriously. I didn't go to work. They were standing in the half-lit hall, leaning against the wall, not knowing what else to talk about.
You know what, Natasha?
Wolf suddenly ventured, pushing his broad, soft back away from the wall and thrusting his hands deep into the pockets of his wrinkled gray trousers.
Let's take a trip to the country today. We'll be back by 6. What do you say?
Natasha stood with one shoulder pressed against the wall, also pushing away slightly.
How can I leave Father alone? Still, though.
Wolf suddenly cheered up.
Natasha, sweetheart, come on. Please. Your dad is all right today, isn't he? And the landlady is nearby in case he needs anything.
Yes, that's true. Natasha said slowly.
I'll tell him.
And with a flip of her skirt, she turned back into the room. Fully dressed, but without his shirt collar, Krenov was feebly groping for something on the table.
Natasha! Natasha! You forgot to buy the papers yesterday.
Natasha busied herself brewing some tea on the alcohol stove.
Daddy, today I'd like to take a trip to the country. Wolf invited me.
Of course, darling, you must go,
said Krenov, and the bluish whites of his eyes filled with tears.
Believe me, I'm better today. If only it weren't for this ridiculous weakness.
When Natasha had left, he again started slowly groping about the room, still looking for something. With a soft grunt, he tried to move the couch. Then he looked under it. He lay down prone on the floor and stayed there, his head spinning nauseatingly. Slowly, laboriously, he got back on his feet, struggled over to his bed, lay down. and again he had the sensation that he was crossing some bridge, that he could hear the noise of a lumber mill, that yellow tree trunks were floating, that his feet were sinking deep into the moist sawdust, that a cool wind was blowing from the river, chilling him through and through. 4.
Yes, all my travels. Oh, Natasha, I sometimes felt like a god. I saw the Palace of Shadows in Ceylon and shot at tiny emerald birds in Madagascar. The natives there wear necklaces made of vertebrae and sing so strangely at night on the seashore as if they were musical jackals. I lived in a tent not far from Tamatavi, where the earth is red and the sea dark blue. I cannot describe that sea to you.
Wolf fell silent, gently tossing a pine cone with his hand. Then he ran his puffy palm down the length of his face and broke out laughing.
And here I am, penniless, stuck in the most miserable of European cities, sitting in an office day in, day out, like some idler, munching on bread and sausage at night in a trucker's dive. Yet there was a time.
Natasha was lying on her stomach, elbows wide spread, watching the brightly lit tops of the pines as they gently receded into the turquoise heights. As she peered into this sky, luminous round dots circled, shimmered, and scattered in her eyes. Every so often, something would flit like a golden spasm from pine to pine. Next to her crossed legs sat Baron Wolf in his ample gray suit, his shaved head bent, still tossing his dry cone. Natasha sighed. In the Middle Ages, she said, gazing at the tops of the pines, they would have burned me at the stake, or sanctified me. I sometimes have strange sensations, like a kind of ecstasy. Then I become almost weightless. I feel I'm floating somewhere, and I understand everything, life, death, everything. Once when I was about 10, I was sitting in the dining room, drawing something. Then I got tired and started thinking. Suddenly, very rapidly, in came a woman, barefoot, wearing faded blue garments, with a large, heavy belly, and her face was small and thin and yellow, with extraordinarily gentle, extraordinarily mysterious eyes. Without looking at me, she hurried past and disappeared into the next room. I was not frightened. For some reason, I thought she had come to wash the floors. I never encountered that woman again. But you know who she was? The Virgin Mary.
Wolf smiled. What makes you think that, Natasha?
I know. She appeared to me in a dream 5 years later. She was holding a child, and at her feet there were cherubs propped on their elbows, just like in the Raphael painting, only they were alive. Besides that, I sometimes have other, very little visions. When they took Father away in Moscow and I remained alone in the house, here's what happened. On the desk there was a small bronze bell like the ones they put on cows in the Tyrol. Suddenly, it rose into the air, started tinkling, and then fell. What a marvelous pure sound.
Wolf gave her a strange look, then threw the pine cone far away, and spoke in a cold, opaque voice.
There is something I must tell you, Natasha. You see, I have never been to Africa or to India. It's all a lie. I am now nearly 30, but apart from 2 or 3 Russian towns and a dozen villages and this forlorn country, I have not seen anything. Please forgive me.
He smiled a melancholy smile. He suddenly felt intolerable pity for the grandiose fantasies that had sustained him since childhood. The weather was autumnally dry and warm. The pines barely creaked as their gold-hued tops swayed.
An ant,
said Natasha, getting up and patting her skirt and stockings. We've been sitting on some ants.
Do you despise me very much? Asked Wolf.
She laughed.
Don't be silly. After all, we are even. Everything I told you about my ecstasies and the Virgin Mary and the little bell was fantasy. I thought it all up one day, and after that, naturally, I had the impression that it had really happened.
That's just it, said Wolf, beaming.
Tell me some more about your travels, asked Natasha, intending no sarcasm. With a habitual gesture, Wolf took out his solid cigar case.
At your service.
Once, when I was sailing on a schooner from Borneo to Sumatra.
5. A gentle slope descended toward the lake. The posts of the wooden jetty were reflected like gray spirals in the water. Beyond the lake was the same dark pine forest, but here and there one could glimpse a white trunk in the midst of yellow leaves of a birch. On the dark turquoise water floated glints of clouds, and Natasha suddenly recalled Levitan's landscapes. She had the impression that they were in Russia, that you could only be in Russia when such torrid happiness constricts your throat, and she was happy that Wolf was recounting such marvelous nonsense, and with his little noises, launching small flat stones, which magically skidded and skipped along the water. On this day there were no people to be seen. Only occasional cloudlets of exclamation or laughter were audible. And on the lake there hovered a white wing, a yacht's sail. They walked for a long time along the shore, ran up the slippery slope, and found a path where the raspberry bushes emitted a whiff of black damp. A little farther, right by the water, there was a café, quite deserted, with nary a waitress nor a customer to be seen, as if there were a fire somewhere, and they had all run off to look, taking with them their mugs and their plates. Wolf and Natasha walked around the café, then sat down at an empty table and pretended that they were eating and drinking, and an orchestra was playing. And while they were joking, Natasha suddenly thought she heard the distinct sound of real orange-hued wind music. Then, with a mysterious smile, she gave a start and ran off along the shore. Baron Wolf ponderously loped after her.
Wait, Natasha! We haven't paid yet!
Afterward, they found an apple-green meadow, bordered by sedge, through which the sun made the water gleam like liquid gold. And Natasha, squinting and inflating her nostrils, repeated several times,
"My God, how wonderful!"
Wolf felt hurt by the unresponsive echo and fell silent. And at that airy, sunlit instant beside the wide lake, a certain sadness flew past like a melodious beetle. Natasha frowned and said,
"For some reason, I have a feeling that Father is worse again. Maybe I should not have left him alone."
Wolf remembered seeing the old man's thin legs, glossy with gray bristles, as he hopped back into bed. He thought, and what if he really does die today?
Don't say that, Natasha. He's fine now.
I think so, too, she said, and grew merry again.
Wolf took off his jacket, and his thick-set body in its striped shirt exhaled a gentle aura of heat. He was walking very close to Natasha. She was looking straight ahead, and she liked the feel of this warmth pacing alongside her.
"How I dream, Natasha, how I dream," he was saying, waving a small whistling stick. "Am I really lying when I pass off my fantasies as truth? I had a friend who served for 3 years in Bombay."
Bombay? My God, the music of geographical names. That word alone contains something gigantic, bombs of sunlight, drums. Just imagine, Natasha. That friend of mine was incapable of communicating anything, remembered nothing except work-related squabbles, the heat, the fevers, and the wife of some British colonel. Which of us really visited India? It's obvious, of course. I am the one.
Bombay, Singapore.
I can recall, for instance.
Natasha was walking along the very edge of the water, so that the child-sized waves of the lake plashed up to her very feet. Somewhere beyond the woods a train passed, as if it were traveling along a musical string, and both of them stopped to listen. The day had become a bit more golden, a bit softer, and the woods on the far side of the lake now had a bluish cast. Near the train station, Wolf bought a paper bag of plums, but they turned out to be sour. Seated in the empty wooden compartment of the train, he threw them at intervals out of the window, and kept regretting that, in the cafe, he had not filched some of those cardboard discs you put under beer mugs. "They soar so beautifully, Natasha. Like birds. It's a joy to watch." Natasha was tired. She would shut her eyes tightly, and then again, as she had been at night, she would be overcome and carried aloft by a feeling of dizzying lightness. "When I tell Father about our outing, please don't interrupt me or correct me. I may well tell him about things we did not see at all, various little marvels. He'll understand." When they arrived in town, they decided to walk home. Baron Wolf grew taciturn and grimaced from the ferocious noise of the automobile horns, while Natasha seemed propelled by sails, as if her fatigue sustained her, endowed her with wings and made her weightless, and Wolf seemed all blue as the evening. One block short of their house, Wolf suddenly stopped. Natasha flew past, then she too stopped. She looked around. Raising his shoulders, thrusting his hands deep into the pockets of his ample trousers, Wolf lowered his light blue head like a bull. Glancing sideways, he said he loved her. Then, turning rapidly, he walked away and entered a tobacco shop. Natasha stood for a while, as if suspended in midair, then slowly walked toward their house. "This, too, I shall tell Father," she thought, advancing through some blue mist of happiness, amid which the street lamps were coming alight like precious stones. She felt that she was growing weak, that hot, silent billows were coursing along her spine. When she reached the house, she saw her father, in a black jacket, shielding his unbuttoned shirt collar with one hand and swinging his door keys with the other, come out hurriedly, slightly hunched in the evening fog, and head for the newsstand. "Daddy," she called, and walked after him. He stopped at the edge of the sidewalk and, tilting his head, glanced at her with his familiar, wily smile. "My little rooster, all gray-haired, you shouldn't be going out," said Natasha. Her father tilted his head the other way and said very softly, "Dearest, there's something fabulous in the paper today. Only I forgot to bring money. Could you run upstairs and get it? I'll wait here." She gave the door a push, cross with her father, and at the same time glad that he was so chipper. She ascended the stairs quickly, aerially, as in a dream. She hurried along the hall. "He might catch cold standing there waiting for me." For some reason the hall light was on. Natasha approached her door and simultaneously heard the susurration of soft speech behind it. She opened the door quickly. A kerosene lamp stood on the table, smoking densely. The landlady, a chambermaid, and some unfamiliar person were blocking the way to the bed. They all turned when Natasha entered, and the landlady, with an exclamation, rushed toward her. Only then did Natasha notice her father lying on the bed, looking not at all as she had just seen him, but a dead little old man with a waxen nose. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Stories of Vladimir Nabokov by Vladimir Nabokov. Copyright 1995, 2002, 2006, 2008 by Dmitry Nabokov. Performed by Arthur Morey. Directed by Sandra Burr and Mel Foster. Engineered by Matt DeCoster. Performance copyright 2010 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.